You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Tonight, the Astoria City Council will continue a discussion on how to respond to the city's visibly homeless population after efforts to create a designated campsite stalled in April. But now, this discussion follows a recent situation downtown where advocates say a business used illegal noise deterrents against homeless campers. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
Astoria police say the noise was initially reported as a malfunctioning alarm going off after hours at a Wilcox and Flagel Oil Company location at 5th Street and Marine Drive on May 6th. But when noise complaints continued the next day, an officer visited the site in person and saw the noise devices. Local homeless advocates described the noisemakers as anti-loitering devices, intended to target nearby homeless campers with non-stop high-pitched pinging and ringing noises. It sounded like this. A handful of tents are clustered at the base of 6th Street and on the other side of the Wilcox and Flagel building on 5th Street. The street ends are some of the few places unhoused people are allowed to camp under Astoria's current camping ordinance. One device was placed above 5th Street, and another was pointed toward the 6th Street campers.
They put them up, and it was just annoying. It was driving people nuts, crazy, driving them mad.
Brad Minder is one of the people camping on 6th Street. He said it wasn't possible to tune out the noise from the devices because the pitch and the tone changed. Still, he and other campers stuck around.
I was here. We have no place else to go.
Astoria Police Chief Stacy Kelly said Wilcox and Flagel initially claimed the noise devices were directional, but residents in nearby homes, including Ward 1 City Councilor Andy Davis, who lives three blocks away, reported being able to hear the noise too. That conflicted with Wilcox and Flagel's claim, according to Kelly. The police chief said the devices are a violation of the city's noise ordinance. The company was told to turn off and not use the devices. Local representatives for the company were not available for comment ahead of KMUN's deadline. City Councilor Andy Davis represents the 5th and 6th Street areas where both the homeless campers and Wilcox and Flagel are located. He said it's understandable that the company would feel frustrated about the vandalism and property damage that they associate with the homeless campers, but
the city is, I think, working on trying to come up with solutions that will respect the rights of everybody involved. And I know that that's taking more time than a lot of people would like, but I think, you know, that's our responsibility to take care of that problem. And people can be frustrated with us. That's understandable. But they shouldn't be taking things into their own hands.
Tensions around Astoria's most visibly homeless population, the downtown campers, have spiked frequently over the years. The City Council is set to continue a discussion around homelessness-related issues and the city's response at a meeting tonight. That meeting begins at 6 p.m. at City Hall in downtown Astoria.
Oregon's valuable commercial Dungeness crab fishery has seen significant changes in recent years as the state looks to minimize and monitor whale entanglements associated with gear used in the fishery. Now, more changes are on the horizon, and looming over everything is uncertainty around the details of a federal permit that the state is seeking that would allow the fishery to have some degree of impact on endangered humpback populations.
Many of the recent tweaks and additions to Dungeness crab fishery operations are in fact tied to a conservation plan the state is required to complete in order to obtain an incidental take permit under Section 10 of the Federal Endangered Species Act. This permit could provide some certainty to fishermen that even if their gear is implicated in whale entanglements, fishing won't immediately be shut down. A recent industry meeting in Astoria, hosted by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, was intended to gather input from local commercial crabbers ahead of a state meeting in August, where Fish and Wildlife commissioners are expected to consider a suite of new regulations connected to the conservation plan. But the main question on crabbers' minds was the federal take permit, and how many whales the federal agency, NOAA Fisheries, might allow the state fishery to impact. For them, it is the question that nearly everything else revolves around. Lance Gray is a crabber who fishes the Columbia River areas in both Oregon and Washington State.
It's so huge to us and where we're going with our lives that somebody's going to come to us and say, if you entangle one gray whale, which I'm sure there are people that feel that way, that you should be closed down. And that's what we're trying to figure out. What are we talking about here?
The state doesn't have an answer yet, at least not one they're making public. And the permit process remains ongoing with NOAA Fisheries. According to NOAA Fisheries, Oregon Dungeness crab fishing gear entangled 3 humpback whales in 2024 and 4 in 2025. Many of the humpback whale populations that pass by Oregon are considered threatened or endangered. State fishery managers say the increasing conflicts between crabbing gear and whales are due to a combination of factors: a growing humpback population, shifting ocean conditions that have resulted in more overlap between whales and crab gear, and increased awareness that has led to better reporting and documentation of entangled whales. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
A dead gray whale was discovered in Bay Center, Washington on Friday. This is at least the 21st dead gray whale to wash ashore in Washington State this spring. It is an unprecedented die-off. Researchers are pointing to malnutrition due to food scarcity as the main cause of the deaths. Some whales have shown signs of internal trauma consistent with a ship strike. One whale had evidence of recent entanglement, though the gear was no longer on the animal when it died. Several of this spring's gray whales have come ashore in Pacific County. One, dubbed Willapawilly, swam miles up the Willapa River and died on April 4th. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. A new initiative is pushing for a controversial type of dune management. As Katie Frankowitz reports, it has caused a storm in the Cannon Beach community.
A political action committee formed by Cannon Beach resident Tim Ramey and Tommy Thayer, the lead guitarist for the rock band Kiss, is pushing for an initiative that, if it advances to November's general election, would require dune modifications on the north side of Cannon Beach. The Cannon Beach Sustainable Dunes Coalition argues that the dunes there have grown too large and too steep. They say grading on the 4 dune areas is necessary to preserve access and ensure public safety. But critics say the Dunes Coalition is mischaracterizing and overstating issues with the dunes. They note that Ramey, in particular, was heavily involved in efforts in recent years to continue to allow dune grading for ocean views, an effort that went all the way to the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals and failed. Meanwhile, a promotional video produced by the Dunes Coalition has had dramatic consequences for the Cannon Beach Rural Fire Protection District. Last week, 2 members of the fire district's board, including board president Bob Heyman, resigned amid public consternation over the release of an earlier version of the video that featured district personnel. This raised concerns about possible violations of election law. The video has since been edited to remove the fire district employee who was featured. Ramey says the current initiative is very different from past efforts to grade the dunes for ocean views. He says he supports the city's current dune management plan, but that the city isn't following it. Cannon Beach City Manager Bruce St. Denis pushed back. He says the city is doing what's allowed by the state, which is very limited. Ballot title language has been accepted and is available on the city's website. If no one challenges the ballot title, it will be finalized, and then the chief petitioners, the Dunes Coalition, will be able to begin collecting signatures. Ramey estimates that they will need to collect just over 200 signatures of registered Cannon Beach voters before the initiative can move forward to the November election. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Housing scarcity is still a major issue for Oregonians. New census data shows Oregon's housing supply has increased only by about 5% in the last 5 years. From 2024 to 2025, builders only constructed 14,000 new units, well below half the goal that Governor Tina Kotek established in 2023 after declaring homelessness a state emergency. Years of underdevelopment have led to higher rent prices, which in turn contributes to financial insecurity, lower job migration, and more homelessness. A report from Oregon Journalism Project found that nearly half of Oregon renters are rent-burdened, paying more than 30% of their income for housing. Central Oregon counties saw significant housing growth, but larger cities like Portland were outpaced by population growth on their outskirts. This story comes to us through a news partnership with Oregon Journalism Project and was reported by Kushbu Rathore, online at OregonJournalismProject.org.
You're listening to KMUN. Environmental groups successfully halted logging plans in coastal southern Oregon. Late last week, a federal judge ruled that the Bureau of Land Management's logging plans were illegal. The agency planned to log about 2,400 acres in Douglas County. But the judge says the plans could harm federally protected species, including spotted owls and marbled murrelets. The court ordered BLM to throw out the entirety of the logging plan, which it called the Blue and Gold Project.
Oregon researchers say forest thinning practices don't have to clash with efforts to protect northern spotted owls. KLCC's Brian Bull has more.
For decades, the northern spotted owl has been either heralded or scorned, depending on your view of timber clearing and forest management. But Jeremy Rockwhite, a postdoctoral student at Oregon State University, says controlled fire doesn't need to burn efforts to preserve wildlife, including the famed bird.
What this study suggests is that patterns of persistence of that nesting and roosting forest seem to align pretty well with what we think these historical landscapes looked like pre-European colonization, and they also seem to look a lot like what we think high-quality habitat for spotted owls looks like.
Rockwhite's team has created maps that show forest areas used by northern spotted owls that are more likely or less likely to endure fire. The maps can help land managers determine where to practice forest restoration. I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Eugene.
The Pacific Northwest's drone expertise was on full display in Pendleton recently, with a dozen startups pitching their high-tech ideas and prototypes to investors. Christian Fodenvenzel was there to see whether Oregon can turn its reputation as a good place to test drones into becoming a good place to manufacture drones.
On a chilly Thursday morning, scores of drone manufacturers, investors, and military officers gathered on the rolling hills of the Pendleton Drone Range for a demonstration.
Hey everyone, I'm Yuri. I'm really motivated to keep it brief.
Yuri Kurat is the founder of Oko Navigation, which makes a black box that can strap onto a drone, enabling it to navigate without GPS.
Electronic warfare. Huge problem.
An enemy combatant can jam the GPS signal in a specific area, leaving a drone to either wander off target or drop out of the sky.
Half the drones flying in Ukraine today do not make it to their end destination because of electronic warfare.
His drone hangs in the air in one spot, fighting the wind, then moves to another spot, all without needing a GPS signal. The demonstration shows potential buyers how his $1,300 product can make a drone autonomous. Drone development is moving fast nowadays as manufacturers learn from Ukraine's resistance to the Russian invasion. Kurat's R&D department is in Ukraine, where drone production has expanded exponentially. For obvious reasons, Pendleton, or Dronetown USA as some have dubbed it, doesn't want to be the next Ukraine. But after years of drone testing, the economic development director for the city of Pendleton, Steve Chrisman, says they're working to attract some drone manufacturing and the jobs that come with it.
Manufacturing is the holy grail that I think the state would love to see. There's a window of opportunity that if we don't act quickly, the state will miss.
The Cascade chapter of the Association for Uncrewed Vehicle Systems held a two-day symposium in Pendleton in April to showcase local drone activity. There were startups that used drones to spray herbicide on crops, to fly medications to hospitals, and to pick up blocks to build homes. There's even one that builds a variety of inexpensive drone decoys. They're used to flood a war zone, forcing an enemy to gamble on which drones to shoot down. But not all drone scenarios are terrifying. Farzad Rabar's company, FlyX Technologies, has developed a way to allow drones to land on power lines and charge their batteries, so they have unlimited range. He's at the symposium to raise $6 million to scale the pilot project into a business. To do that, he needs to manufacture at scale, and he says that could happen in Oregon.
Its closeness to California and, as I said, all the incentives, actually Oregon is having higher weight than California and Washington, in my mind.
Some drone manufacturing is already happening in Pendleton. Sigma Design quickly designs and builds things on a computer-controlled lathe. So, if a company is testing a drone and it breaks, Sigma can build a part to get it flying again. Salesman Joby Easton is hopeful about local manufacturing.
I think it absolutely can grow, but there are just so many little incremental steps that take place where manufacturing has to get support to allow that to happen.
Specifically, he said, Oregon needs a direct supply of educated workers coming out of universities and trade schools. Neither military officers nor Silicon Valley investors would talk to OPB about what technologies they're looking at, but they are telling questions. For example, drone propellers are known to break and need replacing quickly, so could a new 3D printing technology instantly print propellers in the field? Back on the rolling hills of the Pendleton Range, Yuri Kurat's drone lands, and he's quickly surrounded by people who want to know how does it work and how far can it fly. He's already struck a deal with a Portland company to start manufacturing at scale this summer.
I think because of the friendly regulation and the infrastructure that Oregon has, this is a great spot.
And while Pendleton and its test range have put the town ahead of the pack in terms of drone activity, Oregon as a whole has a healthy drone sector. It supports over 1,000 jobs and generates about $840 million a year. Optimists hope that could be more like $4 billion a year by 2032. I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
You're listening to KMUN. Tomorrow is Oregon's primary election. You can find more information about the races and measures on the ballots in Tillamook, Clatsop, and Columbia counties, and where to drop your ballot by going to kmun.org/election. Remember to drop off your ballot. Preliminary unofficial results will be posted by the Secretary of State beginning around 8 p.m. Tuesday. KMUN will have result coverage starting Wednesday morning.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. That includes news host and production assistant Ava Berardi and me, news director Katie Frankowitz. To access more local news and to read original reporting by KMUN, go to kmun.org/news. Coming up next, the American Democracy Minute. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The Hail Mary stay application by Virginia Democrats to save their congressional redistricting referendum was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court May 15th. The same day, the first challenge to Florida's map, tilting four more seats to the GOP, was heard. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts unsurprisingly rejected the state's request for a stay of Virginia's Supreme Court decision. The state Supreme Court had invalidated the referendum for not having passed the legislature in two separate terms before voter approval. It ends the attempt by Virginia Democrats to gerrymander four additional blue-leaning seats to counter GOP gerrymandering in Texas, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, and Florida requested by President Donald Trump. Also on May 15th, the first of multiple lawsuits challenging Florida's new congressional map, drawn by the office of Governor Ron DeSantis and passed by Florida's GOP majority legislature, reached a Tallahassee courtroom. Equal Ground Education Fund and several voters argued the districts violate the Florida Fair Districts Amendment passed by voters in 2010. The governor, legislature, and conservative state courts have not enforced the amendment, which led to widespread partisan and racial gerrymandering. Common Cause, the League of Women Voters, and other pro-voter groups also have suits pending. Decisions are expected shortly. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.